time once again for Community Forum, and we are very lucky to have with us live in the studios this morning Ray McGovern. Ray McGovern is a 27-year veteran with the CIA, serving as an analyst from 1963 to 1990. He was Robert Gates' branch chief in the early 1970s. As an intelligence briefer for President Reagan from 1981 through 1985, he was in charge of preparing daily security briefs for the President, the Vice President, the Joint Chiefs of Staff, the Cabinet, and the National Security Advisor. Later, he was one of several CIA analysts who prepared the President's daily brief for George Herbert Walker Bush. He is co-founder of Veteran Intelligence Professionals for Sanity, or VIPs, an organization that is dedicated to exposing the mishandling of important intelligence, specifically relating to the war in Iraq. Ray, thank you very much for spending time again with us this morning.
Glad to be with you, Mike.
So, a lot has changed since we last talked to you. We have a new administration in, and with the new administration comes hopefully a change in direction and new appointments. And one of those appointments is the new head of the CIA, and I wanted to get your thoughts on Leon Panetta.
Well, Leon Panetta is like a breath of fresh air. Here's a person with integrity, a proven record of integrity in government. And that's precisely what the CIA needs at this point, someone from the outside who has no incentive to cover up some of the activities that the CIA performed in response to direction from the Vice President and the President of the United States. This is the big story right now. What should happen? What should happen now that these war crimes, and I use that term advisedly, now that these war crimes have been uncovered, it seems as though every day we get a new list of abuses of their constitutional oath to protect and defend the Constitution of the United States from all enemies, foreign and domestic.
So, do you have indicators so far that he will have the backbone that you would expect in a director of the CIA?
The signals are mixed, Mike. I was enthusiastic as soon as I heard him appointed, I've watched him during the Senate Intelligence Committee hearings on his nomination. He groveled. At one point, he talked about renditions, that is, kidnapping people, taking them to foreign countries, and having their security services to go to work on them. He talked about these renditions, and he said, CIA employees who thought that that was okay, CIA employees who thought that harsh interrogation techniques, in other words, torture, was okay, well, they shouldn't be prosecuted because they thought that they were following the directions of the Department of Justice. Well, as much as I would like to agree with Leon Panetta on that, you know, Nuremberg decided about that. Nuremberg ruled that I was just following orders is not an adequate defense. Now, I wouldn't start with the small fry. I wouldn't start with the contractors, most of whom did this dirty work, or the case officers who ran the operations. I would start right at the top. And really, Mike, it's amazing to me. People seem to be focused on the lawyers. I mean, John Yoo, favorite target. I mean, next only to Rumsfeld in terms of the ability to hate somebody. Well, John Yoo, you know, justified in quotes these torture techniques. Well, you know, I can understand how lawyers would feel outraged. I mean, honest lawyers. I mean, not mafia lawyers. And I'm outraged too. I'm outraged too because my profession was corrupted. The profession of intelligence analysis, the job of which is to speak truth to power. Truth, you know, sort of a forgotten commodity. That's what we used to do. That's what I did for 27 years, to see that corrupted. And we're still, for the express purpose of deceiving our elected representatives in the Congress out of their constitutional prerogative to declare or otherwise authorize. Well, you know, it doesn't get any worse than that. So I'm outraged, too. But let's keep some sense of balance here. You know, John Yoo is a reprehensible figure. But I have brought with me this morning a 2-page memorandum signed in 1.5-inch block letters with a felt tip pen, George Bush. The date is February 7, 2002. Downloaded from the web, folks. It's right there in PDF form, just as it appeared originally And what does this memo say? This memo says, among other things, I, George Bush is talking here, I accept the legal conclusions of the Department of Justice and determine that Common Article 3 of Geneva does not apply to either Al-Qaeda or the Taliban detainees. Well, that's just great, but he can't do that. And the Supreme Court of the United States has ruled that that is a war crime. So you have you have what we intelligence analysts, and I would hope lawyers, positively lust after, documentary proof. Who authorized this stuff? The President of the United States did. February 7, 2002, months before John Yoo was asked to make these ex post facto justifications of it. Now, I suppose I was going to say I can't understand why the what I call the fawning corporate media, other people call it the mainstream media. I hope it's, well, I suppose it is mainstream. I can't understand why they kind of neglect this in favor of, you know, taking off after the likes of John Yoo. But I was going to say that. Unfortunately, I understand it only too well. I'm sort of, my colleagues and I, in Veteran Intelligence Professionals for Sanity, although we were right before the war, although we were right along all along during the Iraq War, we're shunned, we're banned from discourse on the fawning corporate media sites. So that's what's afoot here, and I would just sort of add only this, but it's not an only sort of thing, it's a biggie, okay? I've been in Washington 45 years, and the biggest sea change that I've noticed in the body politic is the fact that we no longer, in any real sense, have a free media. That is big. I mean, you can go back to Edmund Burke in old England, 18th century, talked about the fourth estate, right? There were three estates in Parliament, you know, three houses in Parliament at that time. And he said the fourth estate is by far the most important estate to protect the civil liberties of the English people at that time. And the fourth estate is sitting in the press galleries here. Take note. And everybody did take note, and that's why they referred to the Fourth Estate. The Fourth Estate now has become, in my view, the fawning corporate media.
So are there others, appointments within the administration, most specifically in the intelligence end of it, that you see a problem with or are inspired by?
Well, I saw a real problem with the people who were running the transition team for Obama, a fellow named John Brennan, you know, who was cheering for what they call extraordinary renditions, which are kidnapping for sending to other countries for torture, frankly. But he's sort of in the White House now. He's sort of out of the picture. He was going to be head of the CIA. So Panetta is a far cry better than he. Now, there was a very interesting development that that caught the light just 10 days ago. And that was that the Director of National Intelligence, Dennis Blair, former Navy Admiral, picked a fellow named Chas Freeman to be head of all substantive analysis, okay? That would include the National Intelligence Estimates, which is the supreme genre of intelligence analysis, signed by the Director of National Intelligence. And it would also include the daily briefs, the things that I used to do for the president and his senior advisors. So it's a big job, okay? You need somebody with some balance in there. You need somebody who can follow in the footsteps of Tom Finger, just retired, who insisted that not only the National Intelligence Assessment on Iran, dated November 07, be completed honestly, but that it be briefed to the American people. And for those of your listeners who don't remember this, that estimate said that Iran stopped working on the nuclear warhead aspects of its nuclear development program in the fall of 2003, and as far as we could tell at that time, a year and a half ago, it has not begun or restarted that activity. Man, that's not what the president, that's not what Cheney was saying immediately before that estimate came out. So that took a lot of guts. Now, Tom Finger came from the State Department, okay? Now he's retired. Chas Freeman worked in the State Department. He worked in the Defense Department. He was the ambassador to Saudi Arabia. He goes back to Nixon because he translated for Nixon. He was his interpreter in Beijing when they opened the opening to China. So he's got all manner of experience, but he is in deep trouble. You know why? For the same reason that Howard Dean got in big trouble when he looked like he'd be the forerunner. Remember Howard Dean? He said, you know, I think we might be a little bit more balanced in treating the Israeli-Arab problem. Well, the fawning corporate media took off after him. Remember how often they played that little clip of him doing that little rant? Okay, well, they did him in, okay? And they're trying to do Chas Freeman in, too. Look at the neocon editorial page of the Washington Post. Look at the even more neocon editorial page of the Washington Times. Used to be the Star. And look at the websites that are saying Freeman is just unacceptable because he doesn't get it. You know, we're friends with Israel. And, you know, this concept of balance, that's anathema. You know, if Israel wants to attack Lebanon, got to cheer them on. If they want to wreak havoc in Gaza, well, they have to defend themselves, right? And Chas Freeman, he might have a more balanced attitude. And so they're doing all they can to prevent his nomination from going through. The thing I can't understand, Mike, and it troubles me greatly, is why the Director of National Intelligence, Dennis Blair, didn't just say, okay, Freeman's my Director of the National Intelligence Council, and that's it. I mean, he has the power to do it. It doesn't have to be confirmed by Congress or anything like that. It's a level below that. So I think I do know why he did that. He was probably required to do that. And I just hope that Obama holds firm on this, because it's terribly important that we have somebody who can speak truth to power and talk in an objective way about what Israel is doing, not only to the Palestinians, but to itself. Because it's a very myopic policy, what Israel has embarked upon. It's not going to work, I was going to say, over the longer term. It's not going to work over the medium term either, because they can't shoot up everybody. They're going to have to work out some sort of deal. They're going to have to negotiate a peace that they've been unwilling to negotiate. They're going to have to leave the occupied territories, which most people don't realize have been occupied for longer than the Soviet Union occupied Eastern Europe. 41 plus years. That's a long time. How did they occupy them? By initiating what has now become called a preventive war. And, you know, we have Israeli leaders like Menachem Begin admitting to the New York Times in 1982. What he said, this is a direct quote, let's be honest, let's not claim that we saw some real danger from the Egyptians. We started this war for the obvious reasons we needed room to expand. So that was 82 that he admitted that. Now, in this day and age, they still are not only occupying those territories, but really exercising a kind of repression that the Jews in Eastern Europe and Russia experienced in the 18th and 19th century. It's just, you know, we have the victims victimizing others. And I used to be real careful in saying, well, you know, we're only talking here about the extreme rightist government in Israel, not talking about the Israeli people. But I was shocked. After all those attacks on Gaza, or during those attacks, 80% of the Israeli populace was persuaded that was a great idea, great idea. And so they have a less fawning corporate media there, and even though the Israelis were informed and had photos, which we didn't have, of what was going on there, still 80%. Now, we give $3 billion a year to Israel. We've got to cash in, literally, on what influence that should buy us. And the good news there is that George Mishel has been appointed the mediator to try to work something out between the Israelis and the Palestinians, something that has been sort of laying fallow for the last 8 years. Now, if Mitchell can bring my relatives in Ireland together, you know, he can bring those rabid Irish Catholics and Irish Protestants together, as he did, you know, with the help of Bill Clinton and, I must concede, Tony Blair, Well, I think that Mitchell can work miracles, and so I'm looking for some real progress over the next, well, it's going to say months, but I think that Mitchell knows which end is up. I think he has carte blanche to bang some heads around. So if we can prevent the new Israeli government, and this is a big, big if, because it seems altogether likely that Benjamin Netanyahu will be leading this government, if we can prevent him from doing something really drastic like attacking some of the Iranian nuclear development sites, with the expectation that Iran would retaliate and then the United States would be in big time, you know? If we can prevent that kind of thing, then I think Mitchell will have time to work something out so that there can be some prospect of peace in that area.
President Obama has said that he's going to close Guantanamo. Is that a significant, meaningful change, or is it just really a gesture when you have these other black hole sites that are still apparently going to be operating?
Well, the good news, Mike, is that he is closing Guantanamo within a year, and he has already closed the black sites. Yeah, so he's on the right path here. He hasn't spoken authoritatively about the rendition policy yet. And, you know, rendition goes back even before Clinton's presidency. Rendition used to be a judicial procedure. In other words, you just couldn't kidnap somebody off the streets of Milan and send them to the Egyptian security service. You had to go through a judicial procedure where the probable cause was that this person was a terrorist, blew up a U.S. embassy or something like that, and then the approval was given. So extraordinary rendition, you know, these terms really, extraordinary rendition. Well, that means, you know, can go out without any judicial review or any judicial punishment, kidnap as we did, you know, as those CIA Keystone cops did in Milan, kidnap that sheikh and send them to Egypt for the treatment, you know. That can be done simply by order of the president. Now, I've been talking at several of the colleges and universities around the country, and here at Evergreen and Olympia and at South Puget Sound Community College. And one of the things I emphasize is that, you know, this is really beyond the pale, this extraordinary rendition. And, you know, I was disappointed when Leon Panetta, who said outright during his hearings before the Senate, that, you know, we used to render people off for torture. And the vice chairman of that committee, Kit Bond from Missouri, jumped right over him and says, "What do you mean, render them for torture? That was never the policy of the United States." Well, you know, well, what do you render them for then, you know? I mean, hello? And Panetta backed down. The second day of his testimony, he said, "Oh, I retract that. It wasn't the policy of the United States. Sotto voce. We just did it. You know, we didn't have official policy. The president just told us to do it, and we did it." So, you know, a lot is at stake here, Mike. And the question is, what happens now? Should these people be held accountable? The situation is much clearer than usually obtains in situations like this. Vice President Cheney, in his exit interview, explicitly said that he had helped to authorize waterboarding. Okay? Now, President Obama and his Attorney General, Eric Holder, have said waterboarding is torture. Torture is a felony. It's a felony under U.S. law, the U.S. War Crimes Act, 18 U.S. Code 2441, 1996, passed by a Congress dominated by the Republican Party. And it's also, of course, an international crime out of Nuremberg war crimes. So what Obama and Eric Holder, his Attorney General, have said is Dick Cheney is guilty of admitting to waterboarding, which is torture, which is a war crime. Now, I take some encouragement for that, because they could have danced around that. You know, they could have said, "Well, we're looking into that," or something like that. They didn't. They faced right into it. What does that mean? Well, President Obama and Attorney General Eric Holder also took a solemn oath, as I did as an Army officer, to protect and defend the Constitution of the United States from all enemies, foreign and domestic, and to see that the laws of the nation are faithfully executed. Well, this puts him in a bind, because once a person like Cheney admits to torture, once a person like President Bush admits to having authorized more than 30 times eavesdropping against Americans without a court order, specifically prohibited by statute, you know, the FISA Act of 1978, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, the president bragged about violating that. Okay. Now, put all those things together, plus the fact that in the Hamdan case, the Supreme Court of the United States said that what the president authorized here was clearly illegal, and Justice Kennedy said this kind of thing is a war crime, you know? Something has to be done, and the big dispute now in Washington, and this is more than just inside Beltway politics, okay? This is really important in my view. The big dispute, or the big argument, is should we have a special prosecutor named, or should we have a commission named, named by Congress and so forth, to investigate what happened, you know, and educate the American people? Well, hello? You got Cheney admitting it. You got Bush admitting it. You've got all kinds of memos from the Justice Department, which they relied upon, you know, Well, you know, the lawyers don't make the decisions. Who is the decider? You remember? You know? And so it's the deciders that become vulnerable to prosecution. And so what needs to happen here is not a truth commission, or you don't have to uncover a whole bunch of truth and take 2 years doing it. You appoint a special prosecutor, okay? That's what Eric Holder, the Attorney General, should do. And then he should go about his work doing other things and let the special prosecutor do his work or her work, whoever it is, okay? The president won't be distracted. We'll have the special prosecutor with the kind of authority that Patrick Fitzgerald had, you know, in the Plame case and the Scooter Libby case. So we give that person that kind of authority. It's not going to take long. It's not going to take long. Until they figure out what happened. You know, I think I've already figured some of it out and related it here. And then we have to decide what to do about a president. Now, nobody likes to believe. I mean, I could see the kids at Evergreen, even Evergreen and other places, sort of boggling at the notion that the president of the United States, former president, former vice president, would be war criminals. I don't like to say that. But the evidence is very persuasive, much of it coming out of their own mouths. And if they are not held accountable, well, you know, it's obvious that this could happen again. And Senator Patrick Leahy from Vermont is making the case for the commission, you know, and he's saying now we have to find out what happened, not with a view toward prosecution, but what we have to make sure is that it doesn't happen again. Well, hello? You go back to nursery school or kindergarten. The only way you can ensure that an infraction doesn't happen again is to hold a person accountable for that infraction, even if it's stealing candy or taking too many blocks, you know. You make sure that everybody knows that this is beyond the pale and that person will have to suffer some sort of penalty. You know, time out, my day face to the wall or whatever for a while. Now, if that doesn't happen, I don't see how Pat Leahy can reason in good conscience that he's held anybody accountable or that it won't happen again. So the stakes are very high, and it'll be played out over the next couple of months.
Just about 5 minutes left. President Obama has also declared that he will take troops out of Iraq, although it sounds like his plan is to still leave 50,000 there, at least from what we've heard of late. And so talk about that and talk about the transfer of troops and the increasing number of forces in Afghanistan.
Mm-hmm. Let me just say, Mike, that the situation that Obama faces reminds me very much of the situation that John Kennedy faced when he took over as president and the beginnings of the involvement in Vietnam started. There was a very, very potent military-industrial complex, a very potent Joint Chiefs, staff of Joint Chiefs, which George Ball, the Deputy Secretary of State in those days, branded a cesspool. Okay, they had all kinds of bizarre plans to fight against perceived and real communists in our country as well as elsewhere. Anyhow, the situation is pretty precarious because Obama faces that kind of opposition to withdrawing. Now, with respect to Iraq, yeah, he's willing to leave up to 50,000, but only until the end of 2011, when the agreement is they'll all be out of there. And so, you know, my progressive friends are, you know, sort of beating and say, well, what's it, 50,000? You know, that's not leaving. Well, they're not going to be combat troops, okay, for one thing. And I see that as kind of a concession, because you don't want all hell to break loose right away, but you are going to pull out all the troops, and that's the bottom line for me. If they're all out of there, as that bilateral agreement insists, then that's good news. Now, send them to Afghanistan? Give me a break. And when I talk on the radio or elsewhere, you know, I start out by saying, remember Alexander the Great, 500 years ago? Yeah. Well, you know why he was great? And it's like, why was he? Well, you know, he wanted to get into China, right? And so he entered Afghanistan, and he started being chipped away. His army was being buffeted right and left by these militants. You know, militants who, for some reason, didn't like foreigners invading their country and you know, occupying the country. You know, really weird militant people. And he was taking so many losses that he said, you know, I don't think I'm going to make it into China. Or even if I did make it into China, I think I'll change my mind and go back home to Greece. And that's what he did. And that's why he's great, okay? He was followed by the Persians. He was followed by the Indians, by the Mongolians, by the British, by the Russians. None of those people could subdue the Afghans. None of them could occupy that country for long periods of time. And now you're telling me that the Americans can go in there and prevail, whatever that means? That's idiocy. And I think Barack Obama realizes that. The reason that he didn't give the military the 30,000 that they wanted, 30,000 troops, was because he's a politician. He had a compromise. He's given them 17,000. But I think he will start negotiating with the Taliban and other people. Even Karzai, the head of the Afghan government, has called for negotiations with the Taliban. The Taliban is not Al-Qaeda, okay? It's different, okay? So what needs to happen is a judicious use of negotiation techniques so that we can extricate ourselves from that situation. At the same time, taking steps to prevent the conflict from spilling over into Pakistan. And most people don't realize Pakistan has over 170 million people, okay? Now that's 50 million more than Afghanistan, Iraq, and Iran put together, okay? Not only that, they have a nuclear weapon. And so the precarious situation that the government of Pakistan faces is one that we can't make worse, okay? That's where our focus has to be. This consideration dwarfs Osama bin Laden, if indeed he's still alive. You have to make sure that whatever you do, and bombing, you know, Pakistani villages is not very helpful to winning minds and hearts, right? So you have to do an enlightened policy there that will address that main dominating feature of the situation there, which is Pakistan dwarfs the others in importance.
All right. Well, with that, we are unfortunately out of time. Talking with Ray McGovern, 27-year veteran with the CIA and co-founder of Veteran Intelligence Professionals for Sanity. And Ray, thank you very much for spending time with us.
You're most welcome, Mike. Good to be with you.